Hey y'all, welcome back to But Not All at Once, the podcast for people who own a fitness skip it and a weighted hula hoop for entirely unironic reasons. Children who grew up perhaps in the early 90s and are neither reclaiming their youth nor really getting super fit by using either of these pink, obviously, products. If you think that I'm being funny or perhaps exaggerating, I encourage you to go to tinyurl.com/butnotinfluenced, where you can read a master list of the many things I and those of us in our Instagram community have been influenced to buy by the people in our real life, our online friends, and the many, many targeted ads that TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and the internet at large have sent our way. So there's no shame. There can be no real life laughter that comes from this. Chuckle to yourself, but please don't bring it up if you see me dressed in public, fully acting like an adult human. Let's pretend you don't know the Skip It exists, okay? I will never put out a video. I will never make you watch it. That's going to be our deal. I'm your host, Ann Smith, and this is my winding way of saying I'm delighted that you're here. Today's guest, Tinsley Maness, is someone I'm really proud to have on the podcast. She is an influencer in the best sense, not in the affiliate link sense, in the way that people listen to what this mom has to say. And there's good reason. She has walked through it. It being the trenches, the unknown, the fear of a diagnosis that can't quite be pinpointed, of a child in a hospital, of developmental milestones that aren't met, of comparison to other people's children, of wanting to encourage your child and support them as they are, give them all the resources they need to succeed, but also love them entirely as they exist in this moment. I want you to know that you'll hear me and Tinsley both get a little bit choked up in this episode, not because there's anything particularly heartbreaking happening, but because this is what parents do when they look back with a little bit of time and perspective and with a passion that an experience has brought out in them. Tinsley has now got both the experience and the heart and the compassion to educate our community on families who have children with special needs of any variety, of inclusion, of patience, of caring for one another, of what really matters, and of letting down the pretense and the guard and setting aside the small talk to level with people, to take someone to dinner and really tell them how you actually are, especially when life is not amazing. And although your circumstances may be different than hers, I think we can all agree that for very few people, I would imagine maybe Jeff Bezos, the owner of a vineyard that delivers wine to homes, and maybe whoever invested in Zoom before March of 2020, few of us would say life is absolutely amazing. You're going to find something to relate to, and it's going to help encourage you to be brave, to include, to be kind, and to advocate for yourself and your family. I'm thankful for Tinsley's time, and I can't wait for you to meet her. Take a listen and stay afterwards because I want to hear your thoughts on what comes next, especially in this iffy pandemic, post-pandemic, pre-pandemic, we're in the thick of it, we're not in the thick of it, it's better, it's worse world. I want to encourage you, I want to inspire you, but I also want to level with you. So let's chat about it. You can listen to that after her story. Here she is. All right, Tinsley Maness, I'm so delighted that you're here. I know this is something that is trickier to schedule than it is to just dream up or chat about to moms with a handful of kids between them and appointments and quarantines and all of the possible schedule complications. So I appreciate your making time to talk to But Not All at Once today.
Oh, of course. I'm thrilled and honored to be here and that you want to talk to me. So I'm glad we could work it out against the scheduling odds.
I know it is a bit of a miracle, a lottery winner in and of itself. I will let people learn about you if you want to tell us what your family looks like, how you spend your days, and then we'll kind of jump into your story.
Okay. So I, again, am Tinsley Maness. My husband, Michael, and I have been married for 11 years, and we have two children, Elle, who is 7, and Hart, who is 5. We live in Greenville, and we spend our days working and chasing children and their busy social.
They're far busier than we are.
Yes, yes, they are. I, you know, feel like I need a whole calendar just to coordinate all the my daughter's social activities. So yeah, we're just your average family, and both my husband and I work. I work for a healthcare company. I was in marketing for 10 years and left actually when I was pregnant with Hart, which is not exactly the ideal time to change careers, but it ended up being a wonderful blessing. I'm able to work from home now, work with a wonderful team remotely, but it really, I think, is one of those God winks, if you will, that because God knew what was about to happen, you know, when Hart was born and how challenging the first year of his life particularly was going to be. And so that career change was, you know, was absolutely a blessing. And so that's just who we are. We're not really all that exciting. We like to.
Everyone says that. And I don't think it's ever, which is actually why I started the podcast, is I could stay at. Exhausted as I may be, I could stay at a cocktail party and have a just heartrending, encouraging, inspiring conversation with pretty much anyone you meet. And yet we just so rarely get to that, right? We're just so surface level, and I don't blame us for that. I think it's kind of how we're conditioned, but I love the opportunity to dive in and make connections and have people selflessly or not offer up their friends. Like, oh my gosh, you should talk to my friend Tinsley. She has this great story. People love to put other folks in the fire, in the range of fire. But I know that, well, first of all, let's start with how old are Elle and Hart now?
So Elle turned 7 in July and Hart turned 5 in May. So
is Elle in second grade?
She is. She just started second grade a couple of weeks ago, and so far so good. And Hart is in, I guess it's sort of kind of like a pre-K preschool readiness class at the Meyer Center. And actually this class that he's in this year is called peer modeling class. And it's, I love this concept. I wish we had it in more preschools, but it is made up of, you know, a portion of the class has a diagnosis and, you know, some sort of developmental delay, and then a portion of the class is what we would call neurotypical. So it's, you know, two groups of peers that can learn from each other.
I love that.
I know. So, and he just started, it's only been a couple of weeks, but, you know, we were thrilled that he gets to be in that group this year.
Well, that really brings us back to kind of the start of your story. So I know a lot transpires when you become a parent. Everything changes well more. You could read all the books in the world, and it's so much more than you could imagine. So I know having Elle changed your life a lot, but I would love to skip ahead and talk about after you have Elle, you know, your first child really does blow the lid off things. And with your second baby, often there's kind of a comfort and a confidence of, you know, I've done this. I didn't die. I didn't drown. I can do this. It's going to be fine. So talk to me about your experience carrying Hart and when things started to look different. And I want to include this little asterisk caveat. There's no such thing as normal. I hope we all know this about ourselves as adults. Everything is on a curve. There's no one fixed point of what's typical or acceptable, but we are going to use the word typical to describe, for instance, your experience with Elle relative to your experience with Hart, simply because even if it's not textbook, there are kind of expected paths, timelines, milestones that you'll see for a child who's considered typical. I have 4 typical children, although I would say there's nothing typical about one Smith child. We are a mixed bag of strange and delightful people over here. But all 4 of those children had hours upon hours of physical therapy. We had one who did PT, OT, speech therapy, early intervention. We had one who just did oodles and oodles of speech and PT. And we met milestones, I would say, eventually for no real apparent diagnosable reason besides stupid vague diagnoses like failure to thrive or low muscle tone, which we won't even get into that because I didn't go to med school. So we're just going to let the chart speak for itself. But knowing that L was probably a relatively typical baby and toddler, and 2 years later, you have Heart. Was his pregnancy typical, quote unquote? I'm sure having a baby in South Carolina in the summer never feels awesome. So I'm not going to ask you how that was.
Right. Yes. Well, you know, very hot. So, I mean, my pregnancy with him really was what I would describe as very normal. It really wasn't any different than the first one with L. And so, you know, we just thought, like you always do, that you know what to expect now. And, we kind of have this figured out. And the biggest curveball we thought was coming our way was that he was a boy, because I have one sister and we're only 13 Aww. Months apart. And,
Aww.
You know, I just kind of thought, okay, well, we're going to have girls and I know what to do with girls. And, I mean, obviously we were thrilled he was a boy, but, you know.
It is tough to imagine when you only have, you know, I only had a boy first and mm-hmm. I really worried, silly as it sounds now, how am I ever going to love this girl the way that I love Mac? I remember saying that out loud to my best friend, like, I can't tell anyone this. They will take this baby from me at birth, right. But I'm worried. And then they hand you the baby and you remember, oh, okay, yes. I get it. You just, right. you just do. I've just mm-hmm. known you forever and I just adore you. So yes, the boy thing, I'm sure, was a hurdle, especially since your house growing up never had a John in it.
That's right.
And you're in a whole new world. So right. you've got Heart and he's born and you bring him home. And how does that next stretch of your life look? Besides crazy. We know that already.
Right. right. Well, you know, so, I mean, he was born, I went into labor unexpectedly 4 weeks early, which, you know, is early, but not terribly early. And, you know, I think in hindsight, obviously that was, you know, kind of a red flag, or should have, I think, been more of a red flag for us. And then there were a couple of things at birth, you know, I mean, he just wasn't eating very well. He, you know, which isn't all that, you know, lots of babies struggle with that at first, but, there were just several little things that we kept, you know, again, because he was our second child, we felt like, okay, we had some sort of, comparison, right? And
right.
it just seemed like something was not quite right. But, you know, we kept getting reassured and he's just a boy and he's, you know, 4 weeks early and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, okay, so when does he eat?
That's kind of critical.
4 weeks from now. And, you know, just, you know, he was, and the thing, he's a big, tall, little 5-year-old now. He's probably, I mean, I buy him size 7 clothes.
Buddy, slow down.
No, he's really tall. His dad's very tall too. You know, so he was a good size at birth, even though he was born 4 weeks early. So I think that allowed him, one of the physicians when we were back in the hospital, this is all coming back to me now. I feel like he used the phrase, the great pretenders or something like that for these sort of late preterm babies. You know, I mean, he wasn't early enough to go straight to the NICU or anything like that, but he was, for him, he was early enough for it to cause a problem, right? And it just,
right.
it took a couple of days for, you know, really all of those problems to kind of converge in a emergent kind of way. And, you know, that's what led us back to the hospital. And, you know, we were in the hospital a lot his first year, and he continued to struggle with feeding. We clipped his tongue. We, you know, did all the things. We fed him this crazy way, you know,
right.
I mean, we saw
it is all hands on deck.
It really, yeah, it was.
Was that his major issue? We had a baby boy who was 6 weeks early, and mm-hmm. they worried about a totally non-scientific issue called wimpy white boy syndrome that you will still hear mm-hmm. nurses talk about in the NICU because it's mm-hmm. common. And It's just maybe that he was so chill that he wasn't really going to fight for nutrition. So we were spending ages trying to nurse, and he was burning more calories trying to eat probably than eating. So what I found, and we talked about this before we started recording, we talked about how I know more kids are in therapy than we hear about, because I could never get my hands on a speech therapist or an OT when I needed one urgently. And that was the time, was very early on. Like, it doesn't matter if we figure anything else out, the boys gotta eat. We gotta, we weighed him before and after every feed on a hospital scale that lived in his nursery. That did not go with the theme, but it's okay. It was big and clunky, and I hated it so much. And I know it was extremely stressful and extremely emotional, and I hyper-focused on that one piece, because honestly, if the feeding doesn't go well, really nothing else matters. So how were you handling that, newly postpartum with a baby of probably a few weeks earlier than you anticipated? Were you panicky? Or did you handle it better than me? There's no wrong answer here.
Well, I think at first I was a little bit in denial and thought that we were handling it. But pretty quickly, I turned into, you know, full panic. And I mean, we have a wonderful pediatrician, and, you know, obviously we were in close contact with them. And I remember we took him, I guess it was maybe his first appointment, when we, you know, you have an appointment with your pediatrician, you know, like a day or two after you've been discharged or whatever. I guess this was the next day after we'd been discharged. And, you know, I'm like, well, he's not eating a lot, but, you know, he's doing fine, and, you know, all that. And we talked through all that stuff. And then I remember we got home and she called me. And she said, I've just been sitting here thinking, and, you know, I don't think that's okay. You know, I mean, and we talked through it all again, and it still kind of gives me like a pit in my stomach. But anyway, we were in wonderful care, and, you know, obviously appreciate anybody that takes the time to sit there and think, you know,
about your baby when he's not there.
Right. I mean, I picture her, you know, she was getting ready to kind of put everything back in, you know, my chart or whatever, and thought, you know, this is not okay. And so she gave us some pretty clear direction, you know, if this doesn't happen by this point, if he's not doing this at this time, you know, this kind of, you know, we sort of had a process to follow, and pretty quickly he was, you know, not achieving that. You know, it was taking us, you know, an hour and a half to give him, I think, an ounce of formula, or actually I was pumping at the time, but, you know, and so, like you said, I mean, I definitely became obsessed, focused. It was a crazy, probably 12 hours, which doesn't, I know in the grand scheme of things, it's not that long, but
it felt differently.
It felt differently. And we just, again, even my, you know, we talk a lot about mom's intuition, and I definitely, you know, think that's a big part of our story is, you know, you hate to keep saying, especially to medical professionals, you know, I feel it's like this feelings aren't always fact, but I think when it comes to your child, in a lot of cases they are, right?
And yes.
But even my husband, you know, so, and he was wonderful during this time, and he was like, no, this is not right, you know. And I remember we started taking his temperature, and it was dropped, you know, they give you the ranges of normal temperatures on the low and the high end, you know, for the first month, and it was low and getting lower. And so we were doing, you know, I had this little tiny baby on, you know, my husband's his big broad chest, and he, you know, we were having to do the skin to skin with my husband, and he's like a lot of men, his temperatures runs higher, and I had him wrapped in this big, you know, the thickest blanket I could find. We were trying to get his temperature up, but that was the next thing, you know, if his temperature doesn't go up, then, you know, then you're gonna have to go to the hospital. And so it didn't, it kept dropping. And you know, I'll spare you all the details, but that was the first, you know, at that time, by the time we got to the emergency room, He really was lethargic, and you know, it is one of those, you know, it'll make me emotional every time I talk about it, really, because you just never forget it. And
it puts you right back in that place.
It does. And I just, you know, it's like a movie. I mean, I could see, it's like I was hovering over the room.
Yes.
And there's this flurry of activity and people in and out and in and out. And they were talking to me, and I couldn't respond, really.
Right.
I just felt like I was in the room, but not in the room. And
it's surreal.
Very, very. And, you know, nothing can ever prepare you for those types of situations with your children. I mean, with your loved ones, but particularly with your children. And when they're just, I mean, I just can see his little tiny body, you know, on mm-hmm. this big table and all these people. And, you know, pretty quickly, there were a lot of people in there, and it was evident that he was not doing very well. And, you know, they were trying to prepare me for all different kinds of scenarios. And, you know,
that puts a lump in my throat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I really just stood there, you know, and I think they were like, okay, mom's about to, you know,
we have a catatonic mom.
Yes. And you know, my husband was there, and,
is he processing information in that moment a little bit better than you are?
I think so. Yes. And honestly, you know, when I listened to your podcast, the one you did with Sangeeta Hardy, and I remember you asking her about like her husband processing, you know, everything and her processing. And I feel like at one point she said something like, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, I think about is I'm not really sure how he processed it, because I was so focused on,
yes, you know, it's every man for himself.
Yeah. And that's, you know, a lot of how I feel about Hart's first year is, I mean, you know, Michael was there and he was supporting me, but I was so in my own kind of head and in my own world with it that, you know, I assume he processed it better.
But he's fine
I'm
now,
not totally
so
sure.
Don't worry.
He seems fine now. So, yeah. But again, you know, it just, that was a sort of a, I mean, it was a traumatic experience, clearly, but it also was a turning point, you know, and I mean, he was only 3 or 4 days old at this point,
right.
But
the stakes are so high. Yes. You don't have a child who's old enough to tell you this hurts. And I say that to new parents all the time. It's so different when you have a child who's old enough. A few years ago, probably right before COVID, I had a daughter tell me, you know, my ear feels funny and it makes a weird noise when I lay down on the pillow. And I'd never had an ear infection diagnosed to one of our children that way.
Right.
Normally, honestly, they would go to well visits and the doctor would be like, surprise. She has an ear infection. You're a terrible parent. Congratulations at failing your children. But it really does change everything when you have a child whose reactions you can read, and also years with them to get to know them and what's normal. And 3 or 4 days in, you're physically still recovering. You've had no sleep and you barely know the little dude on the table. But there is something about, like, yes, you don't have an MD, you don't have a PhD, but you are the expert at heart at this point. No one knows him better than you do.
Right.
Which gives you, I mean, that goes back to that mom's intuition. Mm-hmm. I want to encourage people, and I want to go back and encourage myself. I try not to think about it too much, honestly, because I have a child who had a very near miss. And I beat myself up a lot about talking myself out of some, I should have called, I should have gone in, I knew I should have, but everybody else said it was fine, and I just had this inkling, and I didn't, and did it make things worse, and it doesn't matter. Now it doesn't matter. I can't change it, but I would say to anyone listening to this, we have a tendency to talk ourselves out of what we really know if we stop and listen. But when you're describing your experience in that hospital room, It sounds like we laugh about it because I have to laugh at trauma. Otherwise, I would just cry all the time. But it's not only normal, but necessary. I finally read this book this summer that people have been recommending to me for years, probably because I seem insane. But this book is called The Body Keeps the Score. And a significant portion of it is about trauma and how the brain handles trauma and the science behind it and how it keeps you moving and it keeps you going. And you know, I have that sense of watching a film at several different points in parenthood for me that I'm not in the memory. I'm kind of watching this girl live it out, sort of. And that is what keeps you able to, like, breathe and be vertical and, you know, still have your hand on your child and not have a full heart attack. So I hear this story, even without a diagnosis yet, with so much compassion for you thrust into the deep end of whatever comes next.
Yeah. And I, that's definitely what it felt like, was just being plunged sort of, you know, head first.
No life preserver.
Nothing. And, you know, once we obviously were admitted to the hospital after that, you know, moment in the ER. And, you know, one of those days that we were back in the hospital with our newborn, you know, and at this point we felt like, okay, he's eating better now. And, you know, things had stabilized and, you know, it was sort of me, I think, trying to talk myself into, you know, he's okay.
Right. Like, it's called denial.
Yes. Yeah. And, and thankfully, you know, my husband, again, when I remember it was late one night and, you know, the nurses and everybody had been in there and they left. And he said to me, he was like, okay, he's still not eating enough, you know, and this is still not right. Something is still, you know, just not right here. And, you know, kind of like, what are we going to do about it? And, it was the first time I think we really sort of, faced, this is different. We know this is different. We don't know how it's different or why, but we can't define it, but we know that this is, you know, if we leave again, you know, tomorrow or the next day or whatever, and we go back to trying to figure this out at home on our own, that we will be right back here.
Did they have any idea at that point, or did they put forth any theories, or were they just trying to stabilize him and get him fed?
Yeah, they were just trying to stabilize him mainly. And then, you know, there was a lot of talk of, like you said, the kind of wimpy white boy syndrome, which, you know, I loathe that term and wish we could wipe it from.
Because these boys are tough. They're tough cookies.
Yeah. And now, I mean, I'm like, show me somebody that has worked or fought harder than, you know, my child. But, you know, anyway, and just he was born early and he'll catch up in a couple weeks and, you know, that type of thing. And we even had a nurse, God bless her, that said, you know, some of this could probably just be because he wasn't on a schedule yet.
Oh, gracious.
Yeah, that didn't sit
well. That's not science-based.
No.
Good grief.
I remember I turned and looked at my husband, I think, with this, like, wild, like,
please push her into
out.
The hallway.
Yes.
You're done here.
I know. He was like, I think we're good now. If you can.
Thanks so much for your input, ma'am.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, but nobody really, you know, felt like at that time that what was happening with Hart was sort of any indication of, you know, maybe a bigger, you know, problem or diagnosis. But, and I, you know, we weren't even necessarily thinking along those lines either. We just knew that this was more than what maybe it seemed like at the surface level at that time. And
long did it take him to go home that first time?
Yes. Yeah, so I think we went home. I mean, we were there maybe 3 or 4 days again. And then one of the things that happened, you know, while we were there is there was a like a lactation specialist that had helped me with Elle and feeding at that time. And I hadn't talked to her, you know, in over two years or whatever. And I sent her a Facebook message in the middle of the night while we've been readmitted in the hospital. And I just said, are you going to be working this, you know, hi, how are you?
Please say you are.
Are you?
I need you.
Working. Yeah. And can, you know, like we got to get this child to eat and nothing is working. And at that point I did not care about, you know, breastfeeding or nursing. I didn't, you know, I would have,
we need calories.
Yeah. I mean, I would have given him a Diet Coke if he would have.
Right. I would have gone straight for Mountain Dew. Like we need those calories, but yeah. You know, you go with your gut.
Tinsley. Right.
If you want to do Diet Coke, you do you.
And so she happened to be working the next morning. And so she came over first thing. And she is one of the people in our journey that I have no doubt God put in our lives for a reason. And she just was like, okay, we're gonna figure this out, you know. And she said, do you want me to, you know, try to help you get him to nurse? Or do you? And I was like, nope. I just want him to eat, you know, and it's going to be from a bottle and that's going to be fine. And she said, absolutely. You know, I am, you know, agree. We just need to feed him, you know? So she showed us, I mean, we had to strip him down to his diaper because he was still, you know, he had dropped so much weight that he would get, you know, he would tire out quickly. Like you said, he was eating, burning more calories than he was eating. And, you know, this is probably way too much detail for people listening, but, anyway, we basically would kind of like feed him on his, like almost upside down. I don't know. It was this crazy hold that we were doing, and he took, you know, she showed us how to do it. And, I mean, he did maybe 2 ounces or something in a normal amount of time, like 50, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. I don't remember how much it was, but it was the most he'd eaten, you know, since he'd been born. And I could feel the weight, you know,
that's
coming
a glimmer
off.
Of hope for sure.
It really was. It really was. And, she, you know, I don't know what we would have done because, you know, I mean, I guess we could have stayed in the hospital. I don't know what the next step would have been, you know, if he had not started eating more at that time. But I'm glad he did, because then we went home and we, you know, obviously kept following up with our pediatrician, but we still, you know, we still just felt like things were not, you know, or he was not progressing like he should have been. And our pediatrician when he was about 5 months old, and you know, his head had grown dramatically, and you know, that's a red flag when they're little. And so that led us down another path, and it, you know, he had an MRI and all the stuff, and turns out he had benign extra axial fluid, which is basically hydrocephalus. And, you know, so anyway, that prompted a lot of other different tests and stuff. But while all this was going on, I can remember, you know, feeding him at night and late. And of course you're like, you know, finding the bottom of the internet on my phone. And I kept Googling aspirating, which is not a word that I had ever, you know, really given much thought to, but it just kept, I was like, I think this child is aspirating, and I don't know why this is, you know, on my heart, because he wasn't, you know, he didn't have a lot of, you know, it's not like he would be loudly choking or anything like that. But turns out around the same time that he's getting the MRI and all these different things, we saw our first speech therapist who specialized in feeding. And I remember feeding him in front of her, and she was like, stop. He's aspirating. And I mean, and it's not that that I obviously that did not feel good. I burst into tears, but I was like, I thought he was, you know, and yes. And it turns out he was silently aspirating, which I didn't, you know, obviously until this time, didn't know that was a thing. So it wasn't, you know, something that's easily picked up on or, you know, noticeable, but it was one of the things at this point in his life, you know, he still was sick all the time. He'd had pneumonia, you know, breathing treatment. I mean, all this stuff was kind of happening in parallel. But it suddenly all made sense, you know, and that really, this time period, again, when we're having MRI and we're seeing neurology and all this stuff is, again, kind of like that first time in the hospital, things sort of get escalated. And that's when we decided to pursue genetic testing, and which I'm very glad that we did, but that's a long process too. And so I'll try it again. I feel like I've probably given way more detail than anyone will ever find interesting. But, you know, it took us, I mean, months and months and months to get the testing back. And during this time, you know, it's like, is he going to have surgery? You know, what's the fluid on his brain doing? Is that impacting his development? Could that be the cause, or is there something else going on? You know, I mean, it was just, there were lots of different scenarios.
So you're trying to figure out if you found a symptom or you found the root of the issues. Would you say, looking back at this point, and I feel like I know the answer, I don't want to be that reporter who asks someone standing in front of like the shambles of their hurricane stricken house, like, how are you doing today? Not great, buddy. Thanks for asking. But are you able to enjoy some of those moments of the first year of his life? Are you able to be present in that? Or do you feel like it was pure adrenaline survival concern?
I would say it was the latter.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I think if you'd asked me at the time, I would have said, oh no, I'm
right. You probably would have believed it too.
Right. And I think that, you know, I certainly tried to, you know, find the joy there where we could, but, in a lot of ways, you know, this really did rob us of, you know, kind of that newborn, you know, besides the sleeplessness and the hard, those kind of hard parts, there's a lot of joy, right? And a lot of newness. And it, you know, it did rob us of a lot of that. And it was such a, I'll get emotional again. It was just such a fearful time. And you know, when fear is just ever present, you know, for a parent, it's hard to see anything else. And, you know, we don't, and even at the time, you know, it's like, I don't want to keep him in a bubble, but I kind of did, you know,
and did that mean Elle was in a bubble too?
In a lot of ways, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, she was still so little, but, you know, I certainly think that, I mean, and it just, in general, it wasn't easy for us to just, and still in a lot of ways, it's not, it's gotten easier, but, you know, to just kind of pick up and go, you know, like, especially when the feeding stuff was going on, you know, it just
That's
isn't easy
your day.
To feed him anywhere. Right. And so, you know, and I think we did a lot of like divide and conquer. I mean, you know, my husband spent a lot of time with her and, you know, trying to keep her life normal. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with Hart as a baby and trying to, you know, keep him, you know, growing and healthy. And
And that's survival mode in a definition, like the divide and conquer, mm-hmm. one foot in front of the other. My question now for Tinsley mm-hmm. and with a 5-year-old is, you said that you probably would have told us when if we'd asked you when Hart was a baby, like, mm-hmm. yes, I'm enjoying, you know, I'm soaking up all mm-hmm. the newborn sweetness. Were you able, it's kind of two parts. Were you mm-hmm. able to tell anyone what it really felt like inside that? Or were you able to really acknowledge that? Because I know I told a lot of friends a lot of lies mm-hmm. about really hard years in my life, but I would mm-hmm. have passed a polygraph. I wanted to will mm-hmm. it into existence. I wanted to believe what I was saying. So it wasn't that it was an intentional, I can't tell these people who love me the truth. It mm-hmm. was, this is a reality. This is something I have to believe to keep going. I have to believe we're fine. Where did you land? Were you able to fall to bits and pieces with anyone outside of your home? Were mm-hmm. you able to say, actually, this is really effing hard, and I just want to lie down on the floor and take a nap for a century?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I definitely held it all in, you know, certainly with Michael, you know, I mean, he was the only other person on the planet that felt
he was in it.
Close to what I felt, right? And so, you know, he would certainly get that, you know, those emotions from me. But in general, yeah, I mean, I wanted so desperately for him to be okay that, you know, I would have passed the polygraph too, you know. Oh, yeah. I think that is one of the things that I try to pay forward now is, you know, some friends of ours came into our life at that point who we knew them socially. The guys played golf, like that kind of thing. But, you know, they weren't necessarily our best friends. And now, I mean, we're so close to them, and they took us to dinner and were like, they had a child who, you know, has a diagnosis and had struggled with a lot of different things as a baby. And I mean, they'd had brain surgeries and all these different things. And, you know, they sat down and leveled with us. And it was, you know, I think the first time I felt like that I felt seen, and that I, you know, I thought, okay, I'm not alone.
Right.
And other people have walked this, and, you know, it's going to be, you know, like I kept saying, you know, I wanted him to be okay. But what I started to realize was that this was going to be okay, whatever that means.
Right.
But not necessarily the way that I want it to be, the way that I planned it to be. You know, I think that's probably a recurring theme in a lot of your stories.
Yes.
Is accepting and embracing, you know, this is different and it is incredibly hard, but we're going to get through it. And, you know, this couple, their little girl, she's amazing. And she really, you know, all you need is somebody to kind of throw you a lifeline, right? And they did that for us. And, you know, I was able to look at their little girl and all of the things that physicians and specialists and everybody had said she would never do. And she was doing all of those things and more, you know, and that gave me so much hope and so much peace. And that's something that I now, you know, we get connected, like you were saying, you know, people put you in touch with, you know, their friends whose child is starting therapy or whatever, because they don't know anybody else. Right?
Right.
And that happens to us a good bit now. And I consider it truly a gift and an honor to talk to other parents and say, you know, we've been there, you know, and your journey is going to be different than ours. And your child's diagnosis is different than ours, but you know, it you will be able to find meaning in it. You will be able to find purpose in it, and your child will continue to grow and develop in whatever way they were meant to grow and develop. And I know we talked about this at the beginning too, you know, there's the curve or whatever, and Hart's curve is completely different than L's, right? And
right.
L's is completely different than, you know, our neighbor's child. And, you know, all of these children, whether they have a diagnosis or not, you know, follow their own curve. And I think that the more we can talk about that and the more we can embrace as parents, you know, again, this is different. This is hard.
Right.
This is a lot of work. But it's also okay. And for us, we have been blessed in that, you know, Hart has done things differently and maybe even some things not at all, but he's continued to move forward in his own way. And that's all we could ever ask for. And I think really it's all we ever should have asked of our children, or expected for our children, but I never would have seen it that way,
right,
had I not had Hart. And
it's a lot easier to view the world in a checklist or in mm-hmm. a black and white timeline manner. But I love, and most people, at least I kind of absorbed or inherited this view from the therapist who came into our home, literally came alongside me, mm-hmm. just pajamas, puffy eyes, dirty hair. And what they wanted, this makes me really emotional, sorry. I've cried over far dumber things, so this is really...
Oh, listen, I get it.
what they want for my child is whatever their finish line is, whatever their level of success and happiness and growth and achievement. We just want to equip them and give them whatever they need to get to that point and not measure them by anyone else's standards. Mm-hmm. And that is such, for me at least, having four children and especially having the first one be a bit of an overachiever in mm-hmm. the way that I think a lot of firstborn kids are. Things can seem pretty dire when your kid's not, when you go to the pediatrician and they just go down the 18-month checklist.
Right.
And not only is my child not walking, but they're not really standing. And, you know, we're doing all the things we can do, and that's just as good as it's going to get. And it's still pretty hurtful. And I say that with full knowledge that people have children with diagnoses who are not in typical school or never mm-hmm. walk or never stand. But I just say that because I wish I had understood sooner,
right,
that we're not here to make one carbon copy child mm-hmm. and have everyone reach those same milestones at the same point. You know, I have a kid who's obsessed with dinosaurs, like the one who asked me, "Hey, Mama, how was your day? What's your third favorite dinosaur?" And I really don't even, I mean, growing up, there were like six dinosaurs. Now I think they're about 423. So my paleontology vocabulary is pretty limited, but I don't want him to be just like his other sibling who's, you know, completely obsessed with history or whatever the case may be. So why am I pinning my hopes to kids' books? That would be my other advice, is toss the milestones. If you are working hard, if your kid is working hard and you have pediatricians and therapists, they know what's going on. You don't need to distract yourself by lamenting over every milestone that's slightly delayed. And in fact, I may repost this week. There's a video of our youngest crawling for the first time. I think she was about 16 and a half months old. And I would normally, with my older children, have been a little hesitant to put that out into the world. But her older sister, golly, you're going to make me weep. Her older sister's sheer delight,
yes,
complete mm-hmm. rejoicing at her baby doing something that plenty of her peers did, maybe a year before even, was so contagious. And she was just celebrating her sister right where she was and motivated her with a Care Bear that she knew she really, really wanted to get her hands on. And I wish I could take more of that spirit with me. So I know that you've absorbed a lot of that in the 5 years since Heart was born, but I'd like to hear, in the same way that our guest Kat Stevens talked about the search for a diagnosis, the search for a label, and if having one would change your daily life. You know, some diagnoses have a pretty clear timeline, boundaries, definitions, and some are more of kind of a bucket with all manner of people. Where did y'all land? Did you get a diagnosis? Did it change things? Were you hungry for that clarity, or were you just open to whatever Heart brought your way?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So when we started down the path for a diagnosis, and so with our pediatrician and with other specialists that we had seen, there wasn't what's the word I'm looking for? This is the diagnosis, right? We knew it was going to be something that wasn't easily diagnosed, and maybe we would never get one. But I would say that was one of the things that I was sort of hyper focused on at that time, because I just needed to know. And I thought that having the diagnosis would kind of bring everything into focus, and I'm, you know, kind of a control freak. And
you're firstborn, right?
Yes.
This is pretty typical.
Yes. And I thought, this is, you know, the things that I can control, I'm going to control the hell out of, you know, and that's what I thought that the diagnosis would help me do. And again, it was, you know, this very long process. And when we finally got it, at this point, he was just over a year old, and it was a hard day. And, you know, actually my husband and daughter happened to be out of town, and Heart and I were waiting at the neurosurgeon's office, actually. And sometimes you can wait at this particular office for a long time.
It's because there's one neurosurgeon in the entirety of the upstate that
correct.
Works solely with children. But that's a different story for a different day.
Right. And he is amazing and a huge part of the story too. But we were just waiting. And actually, now that I think back, this is, but I had shown up on the wrong day to boot for our appointment.
Done that before.
And they said, well, you can wait. And I thought, you know, well, we're going to wait anyway, even if I'm showing up at the right time. So we were just waiting, and I took a phone call, and of course, then they called us back. So I'm literally walking back to, you know, with Heart on the phone, following the nurse, going to see the neurosurgeon, and they gave me this diagnosis over the phone. And which I had asked them to do, you know, mm-hmm. She's like, it's now a good time. I'm like, sure.
Why not?
Right. And so, it's very rare. And, you know, I'm sorry, I'm bouncing around, but to finish this portion of the story, because I think what is so important about our story too, is all of the ways, all of these different people that came into our lives that really made all the difference. And one of them is that the neurosurgeon. And when I got into, you know, the little, it's not an office. That's the word I'm looking for. Exam room.
Like the little room. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm with you.
The office.
I'm with you.
You know, and he came in, I was hysterically sobbing, and
he's seen plenty of that. I promise you.
Yes. And you know, I'm on the phone, and I kind of, you know, mouth everything. I'm like, they're giving me the diagnosis, you know, all this stuff. And he took Heart from me and held him. And he sat there, like, with Heart on his hip, kind of
You
bouncing.
Want me to cry. Like, I feel like that's what you're trying to do.
And bounced him around, and he waited with me, which he did not have time to do, you know, and he did. And
right.
I hung up the phone, and I, of course, just unloaded on him, and he was like, they gave you that diagnosis over the phone, you know, and all this stuff. And I'm like, no, I wanted them to, and He said, I'm calling
we're going to rumble in the jungle.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the genetic counselors is who called me, but he said, I'm calling the doctor right now, and he did. He gets out, he calls our geneticist, who we adore also. And he's like, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm standing in line at Disney World with my grandkids.
You're about to get an earful.
Right. And so anyway, it just one of those moments, though, where, I was a wreck. It's like I wanted him to have a diagnosis, and then I got one and I didn't want it, right. And
was it something you had heard of at that point?
No. And that's, it's now his diagnosis, he's got a very rare genetic microdeletion syndrome.
Okay.
Which basically means that he, on his second chromosome, he is missing a large chunk of genes. And the second chromosome is pretty important. It controls a lot of growth and development. And so, the fact that he's missing, it's 96 genes on his second chromosome, is important. And it does, it would explain why his growth and development, was impacted, but it didn't give us really any answers. And so I'm glad we got it. I'm glad we pursued the knowing. And I'm glad that at this point in time, despite the initial hysterics, and I was able to, with the help of friends again, step back. And the same friend that I was mentioning earlier said to me, by the way, so now our neurosurgeon knows, this friend knows, our babysitter knew at the time when I got home, and Michael still does not know, which luckily he did not hold that against me. But what she said to me was, Tinsley, he is the same child walking into that appointment or out of that appointment that he was walking into it. And that really stuck with me and was exactly what I needed to hear, because I think, and this is the other thing I tell parents that we talk to now, you get so hung up in the knowing and the wanting to know and the labels. And sometimes, those labels don't really come with any clarity or any sort of, it's so rare that at the time when we got the diagnosis, there was this one medical journal article about it, about two other boys that had the same microdeletion. And that was it. So
is this a congenital thing? Is this something that happens just with him specifically, or is it an inherited aspect?
So it's hard to say. We didn't pursue testing for ourselves at that time to see mm-hmm. whether it was inherited or not. In all likelihood, one of us probably has, one of us probably has a similar, deletion, but for whatever reason, it doesn't cause us any of the same issues that it's caused for Hart.
Right.
Or it could have just been spontaneous. It seems like there's a spontaneous mutation, And so it seems like either one has about the same chance of being explaining this. And mm-hmm. I think if we were going to have had additional children, we might have explored that and additional testing for ourselves, but it comes up every now and then at our appointments, and we did not test our daughter. We didn't feel like there was any reason to. And I think it's something, one day as she gets older and, when she's an adult, we'll talk to her about it. And if she wants to get tested and, she can make that decision,
right.
with us, but it's a slippery slope, I guess, from my standpoint in the knowing, right? Like I want to know it all, but also you have to be careful, because for me, knowing too much, I think can also be.
It's Pandora's box.
And just more to worry about. So, you know, he's very rare as we know. but the diagnosis, you know, really just told us what we already knew, that his growth and development would be impacted. And, you know, the geneticist went through the article with us in that appointment, but at one point I stopped him and said, is, you know, so exactly what, you know, like the growth and development for these other two boys, are you saying this is exactly the path that Hart will follow? I mean, is this a guarantee?
Can they even know that?
Well, no. And he said, no, yeah. I'm not saying that at all. And I said, okay, then I don't want to hear anymore.
Right. Because it may not even apply.
It may not even apply. And to this day, I have not read that article. I mean, it's only, you know, a handful of pages, but I haven't read it because I just want to focus on Hart. And I think if there were, you know, I certainly think there are a lot of diagnoses that give you, you know, more clear clues of, okay, you know, this is something we need to watch, and that, you know, even more medical things, right? You know, but we really didn't get a lot of that. And so I said, I'm going to put this over here. I have this big binder. It sits in there, but I don't want to focus on that because that will further rob me of the joy that's Hart, you know? Mm-hmm. And so,
that's a beautiful way to look at it, and probably to reclaim a lot of what was taken from you just in trying to stabilize and survive, and get through all of the what ifs and what's happening of that first year. So you've now got this diagnosis. You probably have a deep bench in place of pediatricians and neurosurgeons and therapists and experts who are coming in. So at what point do you have enough free brain cells to decide, this has changed my life, I want to do more? I want to advocate, support, encourage, inform. At what point do you think, yeah, I've got the time and the emotional capacity to take on more? Because that just, I mean, you're still in the thick of it with two young children. And I know that this is work that you're passionate about and something that you're known for in our community. So at what point do you decide, yeah, I think I'm going to pick up another ball and start juggling?
Well, I mean, you know, I think as moms, that's a lot of ways what we do. I think we are always advocating for our children in lots of different ways. And I think having a child who, you know, is rare and has had to have a lot of different medical care. And at this point, he's doing at least six different therapy appointments a week. You know, you realize, and I hope if any of our wonderful therapists or medical team, anybody ever should listen to this, they know that how greatly I think of all of them. But I think what really got to me was we have access to the best care. We have access to therapy. But we still have to push for this, right? Mm-hmm. And you still nobody knows your child like you do. And I still felt like I had to advocate for him. And I still do. And, you know, and that changes you. And, or at least it changed me.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've been telling some friends this recently. It's like Hart opened my eyes and to so many different things. And I'm so grateful to him for that. And he's made me different in a way that is maybe not always, I feel like, everybody's cup of tea now, but I don't,
that's okay.
Right. And I don't know how to be different now, you know, and the gifts that we were given in terms of people that reached out to us and spent extra time with us when they certainly didn't have extra time to share, and or, you know, the doctors and nurses that let me sit in their office for 2 hours when they probably had 45 minutes scheduled for our appointment. Right. You know, I can see those now for the gifts that they truly are. And I guess what inspires me, and I would definitely not say I'm not known for being in our community for anything, but what's inspired me to sort of want to move that ball forward is I just truly feel this. I've got to pass that. I've got to pay that forward. And there's so many families. Like if I can keep, I think you said this, something like this, and when you were talking about your family story is, if it helps one mom in the middle of the night or one parent, you know, who feels like I did and that I absolutely was scrounging around in the middle of the dark just with no answers, you know, if it helps anybody even just a little bit, then, you know, then I want to do it. And so I don't know if that, I guess that's kind of a long way of
it. It does. No, and I think what you're doing by speaking up for HEART and, you know, supporting in particular the school that your family has gotten so much from in his short life already is, and I think this is the most powerful thing you can do, is really tell someone, I am not a geneticist. I'm not a neurosurgeon. I do not have all the answers for you, but I can tell you that there's a lot of joy to be had, whatever label has been handed to you, or lack of label, whatever uncertainty you see, just knowing someone else has come through that other side, and whether they're living with a diagnosis or they're living in uncertainty or they have something where they've moved past, you know, necessarily this stage of their life. There's just a lot of joy and a lot of happiness to be had. And seeing someone else really believe that when you're in that stage where you can't, you know, you could pass the polygraph, but you really can't see it yourself. I think that would have been, you know, I think a lot about who I was in different hospital rooms and what I, because I was so disembodied, because I was so disassociated in those moments, because they're just, you just want to get, those people are wonderful, but you just want to get out of there, like ASAP, is I would just tell that girl, like, you know, you're going to get out and everything's going to be great. These people are your people. I've never met a mom who would say, you know, I really loved him until I found out that he had severe speech difficulties and I would totally swap him in for a new kid. That's not how right. any of this works.
Right.
And so nobody would trade their baby. I think what they really need is someone holding up like a lighthouse, being mm-hmm. a lighthouse. And I think that's what you're doing by speaking, even where you are. I mean, I can only imagine how you're going to speak about the season of your life in 10, 20 years, when you have all that distance and all that sleep mm-hmm. and all that quiet in your home. And I used to really motivate myself, and I preach this a lot in different pep talks that we have, but I used to really motivate myself, and I would look at my husband in like the worst nights and I would say, you know, 85-year-old us is going to be so proud. We're going to be like, good grief, Tinsley. We're going to be like, look at those kids. Right. They got through this. They didn't have a clue what they were doing. Mm-hmm. They did the best that they could. I'm so proud of those cute little clueless kids. Right. And, you know, I'm no longer 21 and I still like to view myself as a cute little clueless kid because it buys me a little leeway mm-hmm. to still be fumbling around in the dark on occasion and looking to people, whether, you know, right now I've got a middle schooler for the first time. I'm looking to moms mm-hmm. who have been down this road, or looking to someone with a unique diagnosis or a thick team of therapists they can get you on the waiting list for is kind of all that keeps us going. So let's look a little bit broader mm-hmm. than you and HEART. And let's talk about, you talked about the Meyer Center. You have mentioned people in the community who've reached out to you. What have those friendships looked like that maybe a decade ago you would never have even heard one another's name, and now you're, you know, mopping tears up at like a typical Tuesday night dinner? What does that bond look like? What kind of support have you found in this specific community of mm-hmm. people who have children with some diagnosis or specific complex medical need or another?
Well, I think those relationships are one of the greatest joys in my life. And they look like there's a lot of vulnerability. And so I think a lot of bonds can be formed pretty deeply, pretty quickly. And, you know,
there's a common language there.
There's a common language. And it's not like we see all of these people all of the time, or, you know, even as much as some of our other friends. But there's community. And I think that is so important. And I would also say a recurring theme with a lot of your guests is just yes. this need for community. And we've been fortunate enough to find that in lots of different places and avenues. And I don't know how we've been or why we've been so blessed with, you know, so many people that lift us up. And, you know, another thing I know you love, like porch drops. I mean, we have people that, you know, still do that for us. And I think when you can really be vulnerable with people and you can really, you know, meet them where they are, and where we are with children who have special needs is a lot of times, even now, there is a ton of joy, but there's still a lot of hard. Mm-hmm. And when you're able to meet somebody there in the hard, and, you know, you look at them and they look at you, and you know that they understand.
Right.
And you don't have to try to kind of put a happy face on it, or you understand that it's not saying that there's anything I would ever change about my child, because there's right. not. But I can still acknowledge how hard this is with you. I mean, I think that is...
That's freeing.
It's incredibly freeing. And I think it is how, you know, we can all continue to move forward and find joy and meaning in the hard is because there's other people who have met you there.
So how would you say, well, first of all, this is kind of what we discussed first, okay. you and I did before we started recording, which is mm-hmm. let's talk about the things that people are afraid to ask.
Okay.
And let's teach people, let's give them a little PSA of, because I know there have been things that have been said to me over the years by incredibly well-intentioned folks that mm-hmm. stick with me after a, you know, second trimester loss, someone saying, well, that baby probably had special needs and you wouldn't have wanted to deal with that. And I've never been so tempted to commit violence against a really wonderful, first of all, you don't know what I want, and what I wanted mm-hmm. was that baby.
Right.
And second of all, thank you and good day, actually. Maybe mm-hmm. could just wrap that conversation up really quickly. And I do my best, because you can only speak so many words a day as I do and not put your foot in your mouth. So this is something that happens to me on every hour on the hour. But I would love to have people have an awareness of where can we ask? Like, what's the encouraging thing? I want to hear about heart. I want to hear about how his therapies are going. What does, you know, does it look like he might switch schools next year or go mm-hmm. to something different? You know, L may have more typical award ceremonies or at school, and, you know, maybe team sports, easier ways to get mm-hmm. a gold star and have the community recognize what she's up to. Mm-hmm. How can we ask? And how can we refer to heart? I love people first language. Mm-hmm. I think that's incredibly important. But people identify their children with different labels, whether it's mm-hmm. medically complex or a child with special needs or a child with a diagnosis. So I think our tendency, or at least I can speak for myself, when I'm afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing, I lean towards not doing anything, which is always the wrong thing, by the way. It's always the wrong thing to pretend like you don't see what's going on. Slap a casserole on the front porch and run if you have to, but do something. Where do people step wrong? Where can we do better? How can we talk to you about these two really different, really wonderful kids you have and get to know them when maybe folks are unfamiliar with the world of therapies and schools for children with special needs, but they want to learn more?
Well, so let me be the first to say, too, that I'm an expert on heart in our situation.
Right.
But this is an area that I feel like myself, I'm still learning and reading and absorbing and wanting very much to be, an advocate for. And I mention all that just to say, I know that I don't always get it right. And I surely have not always gotten it right in the past.
Right.
Before I had heart. The first thing I would just say is for everybody to give themselves a little bit of grace and just talk to these parents like me, like you would any other parent at the soccer game, and talk, how would you ask me about L? Just do the same for
just
heart.
Ask.
Yeah. And right. I know it's maybe not that, I know it's intimidating, I guess. So it's maybe not that simple at a surface level, but really it kind of is, he's a kid, he's 5 years old, he's a boy through and through. Just ask me about him,
yeah.
and
let you brag.
Right. And I think, not always, we do celebrate lots of things with heart, because heart, one of the gifts heart has given us is the joy in seeing that the small things really are the big things, right? Mm-hmm. So all the things that we probably L did too, and we were just kind of like, oh, and didn't.
Moving maybe, right along.
Right. They're a big deal for heart. And so like your family in that video, we're all cheering and, L's cheering him along in lots of different ways. But I also sometimes, it's like I want him to just, I don't want every single thing to be so celebrated that it
becomes meaningless.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I'm totally just butchering this. I feel like it's like putting him up on a pedestal in a way, which of course I'm going to put both of my children on
right.
a pedestal.
But we want him to be just a kid too.
Right. Like let's not assume ability, because he is smart and he is capable and he is so many different things, that sometimes I think people maybe assume differently. And maybe I guess what I'm trying to say with, any children who, or any child who, has special needs or a diagnosis, whether you can see it or not, don't assume anything, right? Don't assume that he can't understand you or,
right.
And I all of these kind of things I know are, well-intentioned and people not wanting, to say or do the wrong thing, but just assume he's a normal kid, just enjoy being around him like you would around your own children or L, and play with him, just enjoy.
See him as a person and not a diagnosis.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he's so much more than his diagnosis. His chromosomes are only part of his story, right? And
most of us don't know a thing about our chromosomes.
Right. And so I think just don't,
don't box them in.
Yeah. And don't let it make you forget, I guess, that he is just a 5-year-old boy, right? And maybe he can't run as fast as other kids, or maybe he can't communicate as clearly, or, you know, I mean, there's certainly things that are visible, right? But again, don't assume that those keep him from, you know, being just a five-year-old boy.
Anything.
Likes to make a mess and throw balls and terrorize his sister. And
I mean, I feel like that's a tale as old as time.
Right.
That's a total pastime of every younger brother. So let's talk about Elle. How has being Heart Big Sister changed her? I know that many of the programs that you work with and the school that Heart attends are really passionate about inclusion and teaching children from a young age, because I think I read yesterday that something like 1 in 10 children have something of a special need, have some kind of a diagnosis that maybe gives them a learning difference or a social difference. And that gives 9 out of 10 children the opportunity to learn to be inclusive and patient and understanding and find friends maybe in a spot that would have been unexpected for them. Do you see that coming naturally to Elle because she's been with Heart? I mean, she doesn't remember not having him.
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, the great thing about kids is they really, they don't key into things being as, you know, maybe different as we do, unless we call it out in a lot of ways, you know? And so certain, you know, she is, I think, just by nature, an empathetic little girl. She really is. And she is a great cheerleader and, her own little advocate for Heart. She's the perfect big sister for him to have, because she really, you know, I think she motivates him in a lot of ways that mom and dad can't always. But I also think, you know, she is a you know, normal 7-year-old little girl herself and gets frustrated when, you know, he can't talk clearly, or he very much, his receptive processing is a lot higher than expressive, just meaning he understands, you know, everything, but he can't verbally express it. And,
right.
And so, and that's not only is that frustrating for him, but it can be frustrating for her too. And that's one of the things, kind of stepping back a little bit to your previous question, a lot of times little other children will say, you know, why can't he talk? And that question does not bother me. And I should have said as part of that too, really no question bothers me, because I look at it all as an opportunity for, you know, for discussion. And I think the more discussion there is, the better it is for Heart and for anyone. I mean, we're all different, but, you know, for anyone
right.
who has different needs and abilities. And so, you know, back to Elle, it does frustrate her. And, you know, so it's just something we're always talking about. And I hope that, for her, as she grows older, you know, it will be something that's easy for her to talk about when it comes up. And, you know, and I hope that her friends will feel comfortable being able to have a conversation with her, because again, I think the more people that understand, oh, he talks differently, you know,
right.
and we're all different, and that's what makes us unique, you know. So I think the more dialogue there is, whether it's imperfect or clunky or awkward, or
I specialize in that kind of communication.
Well, I mean, I do too. I feel like I just fumbled a lot of that, but you know, just the more dialogue there is, the better, and the less kind of intimidating it is. And my biggest concern with the, you know, people not doing anything because they don't want to do the wrong thing, and I've certainly been guilty of that myself, but it's just that it creates kind of sort of this fear, or maybe even not intentional, but like a stigma, you know, and if this is just something that we can talk about, even if we fumble through it, you know, that's what we need, you know, because, right. you know, we don't sit around and talk about all the different, you know, hair color that our children have or, you know, whatnot. It's, and not that, you know, special needs or disabilities will maybe ever get to that point, but if it just becomes part of our collective, you know, we're all different, and that's what, you know, differences, there's value in all of those differences, right? And we right. need all of these different characteristics to really have a community that's reflective of who we are, you know,
and Hart's just a part of that.
And he's just a part of it. And that's all we ever want, is just for him to be included. And, you know, inclusion, I think that's I hope something that, you know, Elle will just have sort of inherently as important to her is inclusion mm-hmm. because of her brother. You know, I hope that that's something she will, you know, that she will be somebody who includes as she continues to grow. Because it's certainly, you know, something that's we value in our household. I hope we would have valued it always.
Regardless. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I certainly think that, again, our eyes have just been opened in a different way, and we value it so much now.
So where can people learn more? I know there are a couple of groups that you participate mm-hmm. with and folks that you support. Mm-hmm. Where would you recommend people start if they want to get involved, want to learn more, want to just find some resources, either mm-hmm. because they're looking for their own diagnosis or because mm-hmm. they want to foster inclusiveness in their household?
Mm-hmm. One of the groups, obviously, that's easy to, or social media makes a lot of this easier. One of the groups that's easy to follow is the Meyer Center, which is where Hart goes to school. And there's all kinds of different ways you can get involved with them. And I think having a school like the Meyer Center in Greenville, which is truly unique to Greenville, and I can't thank my lucky stars enough that we are here where he gets to go to a school like that. But to me, it makes me so proud, not just because it's so critically important to my child's development, but just as a person who lives here, it makes me so proud that we have a school like that here, because I hope that speaks to what we value here as a community, and that we do value differences, and, you know, that there should be a special place where children can get therapy and education, and that we value both for them. You know, I mean, deserve to have an education just like every other child, you know?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, that's one group. And then another group that I've gotten involved with is called KIND of the Upstate. And that's the KIND is an acronym that stands for Kids Including and Nurturing Differences. And so you can look that up on Instagram too. And there's a number of different other resources I can go into. Maybe that's something I can send you some different things.
We'll put those in the show notes and let people learn more.
Yeah. Because I think, and again, it's still, you know, a learning journey that I'm on. And, you know, so what the mission of KIND is to, so there's lots of different children's books that are really great at explaining the value of differences. And we're fortunate now. I don't think we had necessarily had all of these kinds of books when we were growing up, but
right.
we're seeing that more and more now. And so the goal is really to equip young classrooms, so like preschool and K-5 classrooms, with some of these books and, you know, different resources, learning guides for teachers and parents around these books, where they could spend, you know, maybe have a KIND week or something like that, where, you know, they go through these books and just talk to these children, you know, in a very age appropriate, natural way of, you know, all the different ways that we're different and we're unique, and you know, families look different. You know, some special needs are visible, some aren't. You know, obviously we all look different. You know, just talking to them about it and equipping the teachers and parents with some resources that they can have those conversations, so that the conversation starts early, and it's something that these children will, you know, just carry with them as they grow. And it was started by two moms, who I know you and I've talked about. So Francie Todd, who, her sister is Mark.
She's got some sweet twin boys.
She does. They're adorable. And then, Caroline Jaguar. And so, and
whose sister-in-law has actually been on the podcast as an, intuitive eating specialist.
Yes.
The South is very small.
It is very small. And, you know, they both had the mission, on their hearts because of their two boys and to really take this and do something with it. And, you know, I just love it. I'm honored to be a part of it. And I love, the word kind because, you know, a lot of people, especially in the South, are nice.
Oh, yes.
But there's a difference, I think, in being kind. And to
me, there's a depth and an authenticity, I think.
Yes. And to me, kind implies action. And so that's really, you know, that's it, right?
I love that. You can be nice in theory, but kind means you're doing something about it.
Right. It's a choice. It's a choice to listen and learn and hear about somebody who is different than you are. And it's a choice to find that common ground. It's not hard to do, but it's, you know, something that you have to do. And, I would say too, in different ways to get involved, not just like reading and learning, but, you know, think bigger in terms of ways you can serve your community. Are you a business owner? You know, are there ways that you can, if you have an intern program, you know, how diverse is it, you know, and, what are ways that you can, you know, incorporate diversity there? And, you know, there's 57 million adults in the United States living with some form of disability, but they all have ability, right? They can all do different things. And, you know, how can we not just, you know, work to understand, and meet all of these wonderful people where they are, but how can we think bigger in terms of really incorporating them into our community in lots of different ways, and businesses and churches and social, you know, settings.
I just saw that Clemson Life, the girls in the Clemson Life program who decided to go through sorority recruitment last week, and got to see their bid day pictures and a little video, and was just reminded of how easy it is in a lot of ways to include people who aren't exactly like you.
Right. And the Clemson Life program, I almost can't even watch any of that stuff because it hits me like so deep. And I'm like, I am going to just sit here and cry for 2 days now. But
it's really, I think it gives me a lot of hope that
it does.
The next generation of parents, that people who are raising small children with different needs of whatever kind, have a lot more options and more than anything, a lot more visibility. That I think maybe when we were growing up, people who had needs of any kind, who weren't quote unquote typical in any sense, you know, emotionally or whatever, weren't on the forefront of discussions, and maybe we're swept to the side a little bit. And I think it's really wonderful that we can have all of our kids included in our brag fest, because if that's not what every mom wants to do, then I don't know what it is. Like, every single child deserves to be obnoxiously bragged over and, you know, have some mom at a lunch somewhere regaling her friends with whatever adorable and delightful thing their kid did. That's, my mom still does that. And I am decades into this thing and do not deserve that kind of attention. So I think it's really important and it gives me a lot of hope when I watch those Clemson Life videos. Although it does make me cry thinking about those moms who maybe when their kids were born didn't see that kind of program and didn't see that kind of inclusion and thinking, wow, this is a game changer. So I'm a fan. I'm a proud Clemson alum, but I support any school that has that kind of inclusion. So I'm so glad that we got to talk today. I know that this not only has been a journey and a really emotional and taxing one all around, but it's also one that's still unfolding as parenthood is for Elle and for every other child as well. It's still happening. We don't ever really get to look back on it and process until maybe we're 85. And I think your 85-year-old self is going to give you all the gold stars, all the high fives. And I used to tell my dad, I'm so ready for life to be boring again. I'm just ready. Like next year is going to be the year it's going to be boring. And one day he told me, babe, I don't think life gets boring again until you're like 89 and then you won't want it to be boring anymore. So we just got to buckle up. And there's some truth to that. Turns out your parents have wisdom after all. Who knew? And I can tell that you're going to be one of those incredibly sage moms. So thank you for sharing that with us. I know it couldn't have been easy to dive into, but it's been a lovely chat. And I look forward to the ways that people listening to this can get involved in their own communities or just start the conversation under their own roof.
Yes, me too. Thank you. Thanks for having me and just encouraging this type of dialogue. It matters.
Absolutely. It matters and they matter. And that's what we want. I just want to change the world one little playground at a time. That's the master plan. It might take a minute, but we'll get there. Y'all, you may not have a child with a diagnosis like Tinsley's. You may not have an experience with physical therapists or teams of people or waiting for diagnoses or sitting in the ER. You may be facing entirely different circumstances, but I know that wherever you are, I want to be of encouragement to you. And that's why I'm so glad you're here. I, as many of you are, have run out of steam a few times. I think I do really well for about 90 days. I don't know if that means my head's in the sand or the clouds or under a pillow, but I do just fine in this pandemic. And then every 3 months, I hit a big fat wall, which is why you didn't get an episode last week, because the wall was brick and several layers deep and maybe wrapped with a little bit of barbed wire, and it was not amazing. That being said, I know many of you are in that same place, and I hate that 90-day cycle has repeated itself for so many of us, what, 6 times now in the last 18 months? But Not All at Once began as a way to tell women's stories and to tell the challenging and the hard and the thing you might not know if you just laid eyes at someone on someone across a cocktail party. But I don't want to be more of a burden to you. I was really tempted to record a bonus episode this week and title it How I Really Am, because if you feel like you're the only one who feels whatever kind of way, I would love for you to know you're not, babe. You're not. Alas, since I can't share my favorite pizza with all of you and look you in the eye and take you by the shoulders and tell you that in person, I wondered if it would be helpful. But at the same time, some of our stories are hard and heavy. We have guests we can speak to who have been through miscarriage. We have guests who have faced even larger, bigger, harder things. So to be fair, there's no sliding scale for grief. The hardest thing you've been through is the hardest thing you've been through. I don't want to add, in the same way that I couldn't watch Grey's Anatomy last season because it was based in COVID and reality, I don't want to live it twice in a day. Once I'm home and on the sofa, I want to be done, Meredith. So let's move this back into fantasy land where a helicopter crashes on a hospital every 20 minutes. If you have a thought on this, I have all kinds of topics about raising children and loving partners and taking care of friends and remembering amazing movies that shaped our childhood. Are you looking to be encouraged, distracted? Are you looking to have your experience in this moment reflected?
some of the episodes that have gotten the very most listens, just thousands and thousands and thousands of listens, have been episodes where people have faced the unthinkable, have buried children, have walked through young widowhood. Where is your heart? What can you handle? What do you need? My heart wants to serve other people. It distracts me. It makes me not want to punch holes in walls. I used to say you can measure my mental health by how many batches of mashed potatoes I made per month, but now mashed potatoes are a regular happening at my home, and I do make incredible homemade mashed potatoes. So if you're in town, let's discuss. But the new level is chicken pot pie from a bakery in town called Strossner's. I just drove to my least favorite part of Greenville and snagged one for the third time in the last 4 weeks. So that's kind of where we are. Where are you? Find me. butnotallatonce.com. I don't know who's texting me, but I love you. butnotallatonce.com, butnotallatonce on Instagram, butnotallatonce@gmail.com. You might find me in Carline. You might find me taking sanity walks with my new AirPods that my daughter picked out a beautiful Reese's peanut butter cup case for. I want to know where you are, and I want you to know if it's not an amazing place, that's okay, because I'm not always in an amazing place either. But I can distract myself with beautiful, shiny, funny Y2K mixer, sorority rush talk chats, or I can dive into the heavy and the hard. I've faced it, I've lived it, I've walked through it, and I still feel it, as you heard from the lump in my throat and many of Tinsley's anecdotes. So, where are you? What are you up to? What do you need? I love you. It's raining, literally here, and figuratively, across the world, and you're not by yourself. If you need a chicken pot pie, a sanity walk, a nap, a Gilmore Girls marathon, I'm wrapping up Downton Abbey, which we have watched at a terrifyingly brisk pace because it feels like a soothing balm to my soul. Whatever it is you need, I hope you get it. Have a beautiful, beautiful weekend, and find me, please. When I say DM me, I mean it. I respond, I'm here, and I care. Take good care, and I'll find you right back here next week, even if I'm face first in chicken pot pie. Okay, bye guys.